At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, the past 5 days in 7 quick minutes, the New Deal in today's economy, and a trip to the produce aisle. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 19th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been one of those weeks, I think, where it was more about the economic currents and cross currents than it was about cold, hard data. I mean, we did have some of that too, but it's a mood thing I'm mostly talking about here. And here to talk a little bit more about all of that are Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Jordan Holman, also from The New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Okay.
So, Jordan, let me start with you and the one, you know, really significant piece of data we did get this week. Retail sales, they were up. Yay, go consumers. But at the same time, as you wrote in the paper today, layoffs at Macy's and Wayfair. What the what?
Yes. Well, so we always hear from retailers the few weeks after Christmas that they are either closing stores or they're laying off. That's kind of like a normal pacing that we hear from them. But what's interesting about Macy's and Wayfair is that they said they're laying off to eliminate layers, a lot of its middle management. And they're attributing that to saying we need to make decisions quicker. We need to be closer to our consumer. And so overall, I just feel like that's saying there's still some misalignment between how retailers are positioned to respond to shoppers' needs, and they're just trying to get closer to that as the consumer keeps changing.
Well, so say a little bit more about the consumer changing, because, you know, we're buying stuff. What more do they want?
Well, so not everyone's benefiting. Macy's and Wayfair have both struggled on the sales side because they're selling apparel and furniture. And those are the categories that have been really weak over the past year. So, you know, if you're a company that's selling the products or if you're selling food and groceries like the Walmarts of the world, you're really you're seeing boom times. But a company like a Macy's, they have to figure out, as people are pulling back on their key categories, how they're going to save money and kind of protect themselves during this year ahead.
Right, right. Fair enough. Okay, thank you for the clarification. Now, Catherine Rampell, The American Consumer. Learned this morning from the good people at the University of Michigan, consumer sentiment is way up. We're feeling pretty good. Our inflation expectations are down. Do you suppose this economy has turned a corner with the consumer?
I think there was a little bit of a lag between how good the economy looked on paper and how consumers felt about it. So in some sense, the economy turned a corner before all of this, right? Like we were already seeing inflation coming down. Unemployment has been very low, under 4% for over 2 years. Again, GDP has been strong, et cetera. But as we've talked about many times before, consumers were still really grouchy. And I think partly what's going on is that maybe consumers have gotten a little more acclimated to the higher prices. You know, again, price growth has come down, but that
Right.
doesn't mean price levels have come down and come down. So I think it took a little bit of time before people got used to that and stopped having sticker shock every time they went to the grocery store. So I think that's part of it. Real wages are up, meaning wages after you account for inflation. That was not the case a while ago, but it is the case now. So I think all of those things put together suggest that consumers are feeling a little bit less anxious about how prices are going to change, what their job prospects look like, et cetera.
Which is good. We don't want consumers to be anxious. But Catherine, let me ask you this, and it's a kind of a subjective question, but I'm going to pop it to you in a different way. You're at a dinner party, you're chit-chatting with your seatmate, and they say, "Catherine, you cover the economy all the time. What do you think the actual state of the economy is?" What are you going to say?
I would say I think it looks pretty darn good.
Yeah.
Certainly way better than anybody had expected not too long ago. A year ago, a year and a half ago, there were all of these calls for recession. So far, knock on wood, we have escaped that. It looks like we're very close to this coveted soft landing. Beyond that, the economy looks even better on many metrics than had been forecast at this point before the pandemic happened. Like, if you look back at what the Congressional Budget Office or the International Monetary Fund or others had expected this economy to look like in terms of how many jobs there would be or how big gross domestic product output, GDP, would be right now, we are exceeding even those pre-COVID forecasts, which you would not expect given that COVID, you'd think, would have a big scarring effect on the U.S. economy. And most economies around the world are not doing better than had been forecast before the pandemic. So on a lot of metrics, things look pretty good.
Jordan, same basic question to you. Use the lens, though, of your area of coverage, which is retail and consumers. How do you think retailers, and let's remind everybody that something like 70% of all the activity in this economy is spending by or on behalf of consumers, right? How do you think retailers would answer the question of how's this economy doing?
Well, I know that they are very happy that the recession did not happen and that people
Yeah.
haven't greatly pulled back on spending as was expected. I think they would say that people are still willing to buy. They're being very choiceful. And so retailers are all trying to position themselves as value in whatever way that means for them, trying to say, like, if you only have this much to spend, spend it with us.
Right.
So they're thinking about the messaging right now. They're thinking about pricing. So that's going to be tough conversations with their suppliers over margins. You're going to just see them be a lot more exact when it comes to their decisions because they know that anything could change. And another thing they're really thinking about is how that consumer confidence that we're seeing
Yeah.
real strong right now might change this year as we get closer to the election. That's something I'm
Right,
hearing about
right,
a lot, that
right.
uncertainty.
Jordan, sorry, super quick, one more thing for you. Kristen Schwab did a piece for us yesterday about deals and bargains and how, retailers are using them and consumers want them. Just that thing you said about pricing power. Do you think retailers think they have pricing power right now in this economy?
That's a great question. I think the calculation definitely has changed, that they have a lot more pricing
Right.
power than they did before, especially like maybe this time last year. But they know they have to be careful. This time last year, they were very much celebrating. You know,
Right.
you heard the Coca-Colas of the world, like, yeah, we passed our higher prices on to the consumer. You hear that less
Huh.
now, but once prices stay high, they usually don't fall.
Right.
So I guess you don't have to celebrate as much.
Right. Catherine, last one to you. And it's about things you've been writing about this week. The spirit of bipartisanship, small though it may be, that has broken out in the Congress of the United States around the child tax credit. It is remarkable for the bipartisanship and also economically positive. You got about 45 seconds.
Yeah, so it looks like a bipartisan tax deal is shaping up. It's sort of a set of trades, an expansion of the existing child tax credit to essentially make it available to more low-income families or to increase its value to low-income families. The biggest gains, in fact, are for poor kids and those considered near poor. So that's, in my view, great news. In exchange for the child tax credit stuff, there is also a set of business tax breaks, most of which had already been on the books and then had expired at the end of 2022. So Republicans got a little of something. Democrats got a little of something. Arguably, the American people got quite a lot of good things. This hasn't passed yet, I should clarify.
Yes.
But I think this is a really encouraging breakthrough that occasionally Congress can actually cut deals and get stuff done.
I was just chuckling because the Democrats getting something and the Republicans getting something and the American people getting something. That's the way it's supposed to work, you guys.
It is. That it shouldn't be so remarkable, and yet it is.
And yet it is. Catherine Impel at The Washington Post. Jordan Holman at The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend. Wall Street to end the week. Forget consumer sentiment. Let's talk investor sentiment, shall we? It was good. Oh, so very good. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. For those of you not up on your New Hampshire state legislative news, here you go. Republicans in the Granite State are floating two bills that would make it a felony to invest taxpayer dollars in ESG funds. Those are investment funds that incorporate environmental, social, and governance factors into their portfolios. Tack that onto this. The investment research firm Morningstar is just out with some analysis that shows for the first time investors pulled more money out of ESG and sustainability funds than they put into them. Marketplace's Matt Levin has more about the present and the future of ESG.
Until pretty recently, investors were pouring money into ESG and sustainability funds. Roughly $20 billion in 2019, $50 billion in 2020, $70 billion in 2021. And during that period, ESG actually generated better returns than traditional investments. Then in 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine and the price of oil went nuts.
When Exxon and Chevron took off in 2022, sustainable funds didn't perform as well as their conventional funds because they didn't benefit from that rally.
Alyssa Stankiewicz researches ESG at Morningstar. She says the Fed's fight against inflation didn't help.
When someone's looking at an environment of high interest rates, it can make activities like building out renewable energy less profitable.
So part of the ESG retreat is just investors chasing higher returns elsewhere. The other part is politics. Paul Washington is executive director at the ESG Center at the Conference Board.
About 40% of U.S. companies have experienced some form of backlash, which can range from a little bit of healthy skepticism all the way to being the targets of political opportunism.
Conservatives have charged big financial firms like BlackRock with prioritizing a so-called woke agenda over their fiduciary duties. So instead of greenwashing, a new term has entered the chat, green hushing. Veet Henish researches ESG at the Wharton School.
The fact that we no longer use the term ESG on analyst earnings calls, that fund prospectuses are dropping the term ESG, doesn't mean they're changing what they're doing, but they're self-censoring because they don't want to be called out congressional hearing.
Henish says the right way to judge ESG investing is how it performs in the long term, even if it's not called ESG by then. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
A funny thing happened in an elevator on the way to an interview the other day.
I'm so
wow, we're stuck.
I know. Oh my God, this is
we're for real stuck. Wow. Didn't last long, but long enough, and I got to the interview fine. Tell me who you are and where we are.
My name is Ken Bicknell. I'm the Senior Manager for Policy Research and Library Services here at LA Metro. We're on the 15th floor of our Metro headquarters building in downtown Los Angeles. And if there were a contest for best view from a library anywhere in the world,
no joke, right?
I think we would win that. We're looking out the window right now. You can see the entire skyline of
downtown. Oh, you totally can. Look at that.
Hollywood sign, Griffith Observatory, Dodger Stadium, the Arroyo Seco. And yeah, so for
nice,
going
nice
east.
Plug for why we're here.
The Arroyo Seco Parkway, also known as the Pasadena Freeway, was built during the New Deal. The Works Progress Administration and the Public Works Administration, should you be curious. And it opened in 1940, making it one of, by some accounts, the oldest freeway in the United States.
Describe it for me as it was built. What was it supposed to do?
Well, it was supposed to be a maximum speed of 45 miles an hour, which sounds like you're going about half the speed you want to nowadays. And the lanes are pretty narrow by today's standards, still exist. I'm sure most people in the Los Angeles area have driven on this first freeway, and it's a little bit harrowing. You enter and exit from a dead stop.
It is indeed harrowing with those narrow lanes, no shoulder, exit ramps about as long as a driveway, and people going way faster than originally intended. It's 80-something-year-old infrastructure still being used, and it is kind of the origin story of the L.A. freeway system we have today.
It has a special place in people's hearts here. It's something that Angelino should be proud of.
The Arroyo Seco is, in its way, pretty.
This was not for commuters necessarily. This was not for, like, we need to get somewhere faster.
It was literally about a Sunday drive.
Yes, it was a National Scenic Parkway concept.
That concept, of course, is long gone. The Arroyo Seco is designed to carry around 27,000 vehicles a day. The most recent guesses we've got are at better than 120,000 a day.
This is going to sound oxymoronic, but the Arroyo Seco is, in my mind, almost cute as freeways go, but it's also a nightmare. What do you think?
It's true. In the book Freewaytopia, the author is talking about his daughter. She's just gotten her driver's license fairly recently, and she describes the freeway as very cute. It's like,
oh, well, there you go.
It's like driving on a miniature freeway. Well,
that's exactly right. I mean, it kind of is.
It is. Or if you've ever been on the old Autopia ride at Disneyland.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly
everything
right.
is bizarrely 75% the size that it should be.
So much has changed in this economy since the Arroyo Seco was built during the New Deal. And it's obviously not the only infrastructure from back then that we're still using. But in ways more than just our built environment, the New Deal was a before and after moment for this economy. A timestamp of sorts, marking how deeply the federal government was going to be involved in our everyday lives. We're going to be talking more about that idea starting next week, a new series, not about the New Deal, but about what the federal government and the Biden administration are trying to do right now, spending trillions of dollars to try to create another before and after moment in this economy. We're calling it Breaking Ground, next week, Wednesday. Coming up.
So it's a little banana-ish, a little bit pineapple, sometimes a little bit of mango.
I mean, it's basically a smoothie, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Oh, I totally had the really happy music on for today. That's so interesting. Dow Industrial's up 395 today, just over 1%. Finished at 37,863. The NASDAQ grew 255, 1.7%. 15,310. The S&P 500 up 58 points, 1.2%, 48.39. For the 5 days gone by, Dow added 0.7%. The NASDAQ rose 2.3%. S&P 500 ascended 1.2%. Heard from the National Association of Realtors that in 2023, a little over 4 million existing homes were sold in this economy. That's the fewest since 1995. Back then, the NAR says the median price of a home was just under $112,000. Today, it's more than three times that. Checking quickly on real estate stocks, Zillow up 3.33%. Redfin grew 0.4%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible, We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Congress has once again and just barely managed to keep the government funded for the next month and a half. Anyway, no lapse in appropriations, as those shutdowns are officially called. That does not, however, mean that all of this political and economic brinkmanship isn't still costing you and me and the other 165 million or so American taxpayers a whole lot of real money. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has this one.
As much as federal workers may be sighing in relief that their paychecks are safe for now, Jennifer Victor, who teaches political science at George Mason University, says those same workers,
they will tell you that every time we get close to one of these government shutdown deadlines, they basically have to stop doing their real jobs for the week or two or three in advance of that deadline and start preparing for a shutdown.
And that's expensive, says Maya McGinnis, who runs the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
We know this is not just millions of dollars. This is probably hundreds of millions of dollars that it actually ends up costing.
McGinnis also points out that the continuing resolution isn't exactly a win either. The CR keeps funding at around the same levels as the previous year, while we, in theory, wait for Congress to pass a real spending package. But that waiting also has a cost.
Clearly, the moment we're in requires very different thinking in terms of national defense, where the risks are, what our national priorities are. We should not be saying, let's not look at the details of the budget, figure out our priorities, and set new budgets.
But with so many almost shutdowns in recent years,
it could be that many of these federal agencies have, for lack of a better term, this preparation down pat, which may reduce the costs.
Jasmine Ferrier teaches political science at the University of Louisville.
On the other hand, the confidence in the government and, of course, in the ability of Congress to fulfill its constitutional duties is a cost that is very hard to estimate.
And that's the cost that has George Mason University's Jennifer Victor most worried. She says this repeated erosion of public confidence in the government,
that probably in some way contributes to some other challenges that we have in the United States right now.
Like the overall negativity, Victor says, is dominating our electoral politics. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
It's a truism of today's global supply chains and the power of modern science and the joys of refrigeration that you can find fruit from practically anywhere in the world on the shelves of your local supermarket. With one glaring omission, a fruit you might not have even heard of, let alone noticed its absence, the pawpaw. Yasmin Tayag is a staff writer at The Atlantic, back from a quest to find one of those oh-so-elusive pawpaws for herself. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you call, well, granted, writers don't get to write their own headlines, but why does the headline of this piece say, why is the most American fruit so hard to buy? What makes it the most American fruit?
Well, the thing about pawpaws that most people don't realize is that it's native to this continent. Well, first of all, most people don't know that pawpaws exist.
Full stop. Most people don't know pawpaws, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but those who are in the know go crazy about it. And what people don't realize is that they grow wild over large parts of the U.S., all across the Northeast, and even down south toward northern Florida.
How did you come across a pawpaw?
Well, I'm a bit plugged into the foodie world, so I hear people talking about this like elusive American fruit all the time. It's very big in like gourmet baking and bartendering.
Wow.
But the first time I really engaged with one, with the idea of a pawpaw, was when a cousin living in Windsor, Ontario, so that's right across from Detroit, told me that they grow wild all over the place. She's like, people go crazy for them. And yet they're just wild fruit. You can eat them from a tree in the park. And that was what really got me thinking, you know, they're so in demand and yet they're all over the place.
Well, answer your own question, because I can go to my local Piggly Wiggly or any Piggly Wiggly probably within well, let me exaggerate only a little bit, 20-mile radius, and they probably would not have pawpaws.
That's probably true. And the main problem with pawpaws is they're really hard to store and ship. As soon as you pluck them, they get ripe very fast, within 3 to 5 days, and they become really squishy and brown and ugly. And so this is the main reason that pawpaw producers say they're not widely available.
So really, it's kind of a marketing and supply chain problem, right? Because nobody's going to voluntarily buy a brown, squishy, gross fruit, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there is demand, and there are some specialty orchards growing pawpaws that, you know, will make the effort to ship these delicate fruit very quickly and get them to these farmers markets.
Yeah, and somebody's going to hear this and come up with some innovative packaging solution, and then we're going to be inundated with them. I should have asked this at the beginning. What do they look like, and then what do they taste like?
Ooh, okay. Well, they're kind of small and greenish, if they're not already beginning to go squishy. Kind of like an avocado. Yeah, they're about the size of a dinner roll.
Okay.
And when you slice them open, they're usually a pale yellow or like a light orange inside and squishy. And they've got little brown seeds inside them.
You keep saying squishy, and I'm worried about a texture problem, but that's a whole different thing. Then what's the taste like?
You know, in a word, I would say tropical. So it's a little banana-ish, a little bit pineapple, sometimes a little bit of mango. It's really not what you would expect from a fruit that grows in North America.
Yeah. Is there money to be had in these things, do you suppose?
I would say that now that there is demand from a certain subset of foodies, there is money to be made. It's a hot, exciting ingredient, you know, much like I guess kale was in the past, or even avocados before that.
Okay. Kale is not a selling point. Let me just say.
Speak for yourself, I think.
All right. Fair enough. Okay. So on the theory that you've experimented with these things and on the way out here, what's your favorite way to eat them, serve them, prepare them, bake them? How do you like them?
I really enjoyed just scooping it right out of the fruit. It was like a dessert in a way. It was like an exotic treat.
All right. I got to go find one of these things here in Southern California, by the way, which is definitely not the Northeast where these things grow.
No.
Yeah. Yasmin Tayag, she's a staff writer on the science desk at The Atlantic. Yasmin, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, kind of good news, bad news. The good news, and the data here is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The good news is that the gender wage gap in this economy is the narrowest it has ever been. Women now make 83.8% of what men make. Median weekly earnings is the parameter there. The bad news is, obviously, that women only make 83.8% of what men make. Lots of variation, of course, by race and ethnicity on that one. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you back here on Monday, all right? This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, Well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.